So, how does one begin to dive into the philosophies and practice of Buddhism in this life? Well, here's a riddle that I'm sure will clear it all up for you. What does a person have to do to become a Buddhist? The answer is absolutely nothing. One could call this a Zen joke or a riddle, or with one of those quote-unquote answers that vacillates between being an answer and not being an answer, and often leads to frustration. And I can tell you, it frustrates the heck out of my husband. And when analyzed in the ways that we in this culture have learned to analyze things, it really doesn't make sense, because we want things to be definitive. We want things to be one or the other. In the frame of reference of this discussion, however, you can take it absolutely literally. The practice is to do absolutely nothing. In fact, that meditation, the intent of that meditation in this context, is intended to literally sit and do nothing. Welcome the thoughts, say goodbye to them, let them go, come back to the breath. But that is truly, in a nutshell, the intent of how to be a Buddhist. So do I have to go to a monastery to practice Buddhism? Do I have to shave my head to really take it seriously? Are all Buddhist vegetarians? What about those robes? Well, my friends, I'm here to tell you that you don't have to do anything, be anything, go anywhere, or wear anything in particular to practice Buddhism. You can do it right now, where you are at this moment, and at any moment. There are essentially two parts to the thoughts and ideas I'd like to share today. The first is a lesson in one of the most basic of the ancient teachings of the Buddha. In the second part, I'll kind of be talking about some more modern concepts that I've kind of cherry-picked my own. But, of course, there's a plethora of Buddhist teachings and certainly can't be covered in one, let alone 1,000 sermons. But the intent here today, again, is to bring us back to the idea of practicing Buddhism in this life, where you are today. The first set of what I call the voice of the ancients is referred to, before I go into that, I just wanted to point a few things out. I brought a few items from my altar, and I am going to, as a symbol, light that candle that I brought as kind of a symbol of the intersection of the ideas between Unitarian Universalism and Buddhism as being perfectly compatible. It is common in a Buddhist practice to make a statement of intention, and I will do that right now because that's something I take very seriously as part of my practice. It is the intention of this discussion that we're having today, that we may all experience thoughts about this practice that make sense in new and easy ways, even for just a fleeting moment. May these thoughts bring peace and joy. So I would like to begin today with one of the almost innumerable nuggets or nutshells of documented teachings and interpretations of the teachings of the historical Buddha and the people who came after him, which has come to be known as the Three Refuges. Other names that you may hear for the very same thing are Three Jewels or the Three Treasures. And it really depends on kind of which school of Buddhism you're investigating. But they do come back to the very, very beginnings of Buddhism before all those branches start. So they hold these teachings in common. I use the term refuges, which is like a Zen Buddhist term. And I like the word refuge because for me, it implies that by going this path, I can find refuge, I can find peace. So treasures, jewels, refuges, it doesn't matter. There are three of them. The first one is Buddha. The second one is Dharma. And the third one is Sangha. All Sanskrit words, or possibly Pali words. Way very old words. The first one, the word Buddha, actually comes from a Sanskrit word, Bud, B-U-D-H, which is often translated as to awaken. So please note that the word Buddha here can mean the Buddha, the actual man, Siddhartha Gautama, or it can refer to any enlightened being. Many would argue that Jesus, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., just to name a few, many would argue that they were Buddhas. In this frame of reference, all beings, literally all of us, are or have the capacity to be Buddhas. This is a fundamental concept that underlies all of Buddhism. So we aren't looking for anything outside of ourselves. It's all within. The light is within. The possibilities are from within. The term Buddha, as translated by the Oxford Dictionary of Buddhism, refers to a person who, quote, has awakened to the true nature of things. The true nature of things. Well, I get stuck there. I don't know about you. I don't know if when you heard me say the true nature of things, you went, ah, yes, of course, the true nature of things. Well, I struggle with that, and that's the daily practice. What is the true nature of things? Am I creating a drama, or am I really looking at a situation in the true nature of it? So this kind of leads us to the second refuge. We talked about Buddha. Now I'm going to move on to Dharma. Defining Dharma, I have to tell you, is a good example of how quickly the topic of Buddhism can get very sticky. There are three definitions, according to the Oxford Dictionary of Buddhism, but I will only give you one. And I'm actually going to give you the second one, which I think is kind of different. But it denotes the totality of Buddhist teachings, since these are thought to accurately describe and explain the underlying universal law so that individuals may live in harmony with it. In other words, Mr. Keon, who assembled the Oxford Dictionary of Buddhism, is describing the true nature of things. So I think that term that we, or the way we use those words for Buddha, we can tie that to Dharma. Dharma is the teachings. Dharma is where we find the wisdom. It's not a person. It's the wherever you find it, whether it's Dr. Carlson's Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, or whether you go back to some of the very earliest writings of the tradition. And this is where other commonly known nuggets of the teachings come in, along with many, many others that are less commonly known in our culture. Two of the more common ones I'm referring to are the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which some of you may have heard of. Unfortunately, I don't have time today to dig into these teachings because they really aren't pertinent to my thesis. So I'm mentioning them here, but I'm also, when you go out for your social time, my friend Amber put out a reference list. I have a list of books that I recommend because people usually ask me where they can start, and I have some copies out there if you want to look at them. So you can kind of pick them up and look through those a little bit afterwards. Another topic that I'll mention just very briefly here is that there are many different schools of thought that claim the title of Buddhism with other words in front of them to help distinguish them, like Zen or Tibetan are the common ones. And it's not within my scope to address that at all in here. Those types of branching occurred over time in cultural circumstances and in different countries that just has spread around the world. So here we're here today to really focus on what I consider to be Western Buddhism, which is becoming very much more of a big topic, I'd say, in the last 50 years. So we've talked about the Buddha. We've talked about Dharma. The third of the three refuges is Sangha. And Sangha is probably the easiest one for us all to understand. All we have to do is look around. Look around you here. Sangha translates into words like association, assembly, or group. We might choose to think of it then as any type of spiritual community, like a monastery, or even the Sangha in which we are participating in right here, right now. Sangha is a very powerful part of my Buddhist practice and being with like-minded people and helping to carry each other through those challenges that we meet every day. So that really completes the first part of my sermon. That's something that you can pick up a book and read about, the three refuges. There's much written about it. But now I want to move on to a section where I've taken a few more liberties in cherry-picking some of my other ideas just for my own purposes of this thesis of practicing Buddhism in this life. I don't have a nice little title like Three Refuges, but of course it's not required, just like anything else in Buddhism. Nothing's really required. But I do have three reasons or three ideas I wanted to share. And the main reason for the three is because I'm pretty good at holding on to three ideas still. If I go to four, I might forget one. So that's my forgetfulness lately. But three is a nice number to manage and walk out of here. And I hope you all can walk out of here maybe even with just one. So I'm going to call these three ideas to consider to help us practice in this life, or more simply, three ideas to consider. And they are Maitri, meditation, and impermanence. So three pretty big topics. And of course, the first one I threw at you was a Pali word, Maitri. And I apologize for that, but I will give you a definition. And according to my sources, this time I was online, it translates to the perfect virtue of sympathy, Maitri. The perfect virtue of sympathy. It can also be translated to be love. This concept even holds an honored position in the traditional Buddhist teachings as in the first of the four immeasurable minds or the four divine abidings. So if anybody has a little more of an advanced knowledge of Buddhism, those four divine abidings would be the works of Master Hakuin, which is another book I have with me. My first exposure to the idea of Maitri was through a Buddhist nun by the name of Pema Chodron, and hopefully that name might ring a bell or two in this room. In her book called The Places That Scare You, A Guide to Fearfulness in Difficult Times. I would recommend this book in particular because fear seems to be a strong theme in our culture. I don't watch the news. It's fear-mongering for me. It's very painful. So that's part of my practice is I avoid that kind of exposure. Unless I was watching that tornado or the storms movie yesterday. I was like, I'll turn it on for that. But we don't have to be fearful. And Pema Chodron is certainly one source of inspiration on how to live without fearfulness. And this book is on that list, and it's also on the table if you want to take a look at that. So back to the idea of Maitri. Pema Chodron makes it very clear to us that Maitri, again, this perfect virtue of sympathy, or more simply, love, must include inner or self-love, and in fact, cannot be separated from absolute sympathy for all other beings, or what might be called outer love. So let me just pause there for a minute. In her book, in Pema Chodron's book, that I was referring to, she is concerned when we talk about Maitri about self-love. And in our culture, that is not a very common thing. We tend to be highly critical of ourselves. So, again, this thesis, how do we practice in this life? We practice by being kind and loving to ourselves. And as it turns out, if we're kind and loving to ourselves, we're also kind and loving to everybody because we're connected. And that's a nice intersection with Unitarian Universalism and our first principles, all of our principles, but certainly the interdependent web. So it is my intent to place the focus, on this practice of loving oneself. And it really does tie back to that fear-mongering again in my mind. They are very closely related. So loving ourselves, being kind to ourselves, opening our hearts then allows us to open our hearts to everybody. The second idea to consider is meditation, or as I sometimes prefer to call it, pausing. In the tradition of self-criticism, this is where I feel the need to confess. I am not a good meditator in the traditional sense. The concept of meditation can be daunting to anyone interested in following this path. It doesn't have to be, however, because like we practiced earlier with that bell, with your meditation you do here every week, or it's once a month in the summer, but whatever, when you bring your groups together and you take that intentional moment of silence, that's meditation. It doesn't have to be anything more or less than that. Just taking five breaths is incredibly powerful. And as was mentioned in my introduction, I've found my life's work working with kindergartners through fifth graders. And those kids, I got them to take three deep breaths every day. And that was quite an accomplishment. So they can't do five, but they can do three. And they enjoyed it. And they would remind me that we needed to do it towards the end of the year. So practicing Buddhism in this life includes pausing in mindfulness from whatever appears to require our attention at any given moment. I emphasize the word appears. On my way here, I got lost. I got really stressed. The appearance of what was important at that moment was where I needed to take that pause and say, look at this beautiful day. Look at all these wonderful things. I'm with a terrific friend. I love talking to Unitarian Universalists because they tend to be very forgiving, even if I'm late. So, I mean, really, that's the kind of pausing I'm talking about. This skill may not come naturally to many of us, and I certainly include myself in that category. That's where the literal meaning of the word practice comes into play with these ideas. So I'm going to give you a quote from the book The Dhammapada, as translated by Eknath Iswaran. And this is a very old writing. It's one of the original writings. It was meant for lay people. And, you know, originally all of the traditions were oral traditions. None of them were written probably for 300 or 400 or 500 years after the historical Buddha died. But on the inside cover, there's just one little section of the Dhammapada, which is really like a verse. It's like it's got a rhythm to it. But here's one verse. As irrigators lead water where they want, as archers make their arrows straight, as carpenters carve wood, the wise shape their minds. So that idea of shaping our minds is where that practice is really important. Pausing can happen wherever we are. We don't have to wait for anything. We don't have to go anywhere. We can practice pausing with the intention of letting all of the balls we are juggling. And this is a powerful image for me, especially as a mother, as a professional woman, trying to do everything. I often imagine that I've got many balls that I'm juggling up in the air. And if for just a moment I can let them dangle in the air and look for that space, that peaceful space in between, even for just a few breaths, it can really, really make a big difference. I'd like to digress just for a few minutes to talk about the particular text that I quoted, back to this idea. The Dhammapada is said to be a work that is very, very old and is based on the original teachings of the Buddha, the original oral teachings. The word Dhammapada, roughly translated, means the path of Dharma. So we talked about Dharma, the teachings. So this is intended to be a book to tell you how to follow this path. And I'm going to read some more words out of here because I found this to be very powerful in reference to, you know, again, our culture, the things that are important to us. Because this is the first line in the introduction of this book. If all of the New Testament had been lost, it has been said, and only the Sermon on the Mount had managed to survive these 2,000 years of history, we would still have all that is necessary for following the teachings of Jesus the Christ. The body of Buddhist scripture is much more voluminous than the Bible, but I would not hesitate to make a similar claim. If everything else were lost, we would need nothing more than the Dhammapada to follow the way of the Buddha. So, again, just kind of a little plug. If you're interested in further study, this would be a good place to go. So this is pretty basic Buddhist philosophy that appears to be written, or more accurately, spoken with lay practitioners in mind. And as Iswaran asserts, all we need to follow the teachings of the Buddha are right in here. So one book. My reference list includes another translation of the Dhammapada besides this one. The author of the Still Point Dhammapada, a woman named Jerry Larkin, Hers version was subtitled A Contemporary Rendering and Stories. So again, taking the ancient writings, translating them into something that's a little more pertinent to us. Jerry Larkin opened a Zen temple in the heart of Detroit, not in a nice section of Detroit. And it's named the Still Point Zen Buddhist Temple. And so in her attempt of taking this ancient teaching, she changed the words. She made it more gender neutral and more in the verbiage that we would be used to hearing today. That book is also listed on here, and another take on the same of the most very ancient of teachings. Okay, so three ideas to consider. I'm coming back to those. So far we've talked about maitri, or self-love. We've also talked about meditation, or the idea of pausing, even for just a moment, to appreciate whatever is in that moment and let go of what appears to be in that moment. I always come back to that word. What appears to be the most important thing here may not actually be the moment. So the third and final thing that I'm going to talk about today is the idea of impermanence. The concept of impermanence in the ancient tradition is one of what can be referred to as the three Dharma seals. So again, there's four noble truths, there's eightfold path, there's three refuges, there's also three Dharma seals. And one of the Dharma seals is the idea of impermanence. The other two of them are non-self and nirvana, just in case you were dying to know what the other three, the other two Dharma seals are. But impermanence is said to lead to the first of the four noble truths, which is suffering. So the key there is impermanence is what triggers the four noble truths. So I'm going to ask you to allow me to use some words from Thich Nhat Hanh. I'm very liberal with borrowing words from people, to talk about this subject. The first Dharma seal is impermanence. The Buddha taught that everything is impermanent. Flowers, tables, mountains, political regimes, bodies, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. We cannot find anything that is permanent. Flowers decompose, but knowing this does not prevent us from loving flowers. In fact, we are able to love them more because we know how to treasure them while they are still alive. If we learn to look at a flower in a way that impermanence is revealed to us, when it dies, we will not suffer. Impermanence is more than an idea. It is a practice to help us touch reality. Understanding impermanence can give us confidence, peace, and joy. Impermanence does not necessarily lead to suffering. Without impermanence, life could not be. Without impermanence, your daughter could not grow up into a beautiful young lady. Without impermanence, oppressive political regimes would never change. We think impermanence makes us suffer. The Buddha gave the example of a dog that was hit by a stone and got angry at the stone. It is not impermanence that makes us suffer. What makes us suffer is wanting things to be permanent when they are not. We need to learn to appreciate the value of impermanence. If we are in good health and are aware of impermanence, we will take good care of ourselves. When we know that the person we love is impermanent, we will cherish our beloved all the more. Impermanence teaches us to respect and value every moment and all the precious things around us and inside us. When we practice mindfulness of impermanence, we become fresher and more loving. So there you have it. A few things to think about to help bring Buddhism into this life. I hope that you can all appreciate that we've just barely scratched the surface of this topic. It is my hope that you'll come out of here today knowing that the teachings are always there and you can open yourself up to them whenever you choose. Thank you.